You're listening to The Dice Men Cometh, proudly sponsored by Area 52, Tasmania's largest independent pop culture retailer. Find them at 104 Elizabeth Street, Hobart, or online at area52.com.au.
The Dice Men Cometh!
Well, Garth, welcome back to the studio.
Oh, it's good to be here.
It's Thursday night.
Sure is.
Here at Edge Radio 99.3 FM. And Leon, he's on a bit of a sabbatical, a holiday, or actually he's just working, isn't he?
He is just working. He's... So he's been sick, as everyone knows, but now he is probably still a bit sick, but at least back at work. So have fun.
Let's give a shout out to Leon anyway, at work. Oompa Loompering away, making the chocolates. And while I mention shout-outs, I want to give a shout-out to a mate of mine who I caught up with on Sunday after not seeing him for probably at least 3 years, but he was an old Navy mate of mine who was in town for a 50th birthday.
Mm-hmm.
And we caught up for a beer at the New Sydney.
Ah,
it's not a sponsor of ours, but it is our local watering hole.
We did spend a fair bit of money there.
That's right. And I had seen earlier in the day, or maybe on Saturday, he'd posted on his Facebook page that he was in Area 52.
Wowzers.
And said, and his note was, you know, oh, Mark, you're always talking about Area 52. I better pop in and have a look. And he did go in, and when I caught up with him on the Sunday, he told me he went in there and he bought a copy of Carcassonne.
Mm-hmm.
Now, did I mention that he was down for a 50th birthday? There was another old Navy mate of mine who I hadn't seen maybe for 20 years.
But that was when he was down last time for your 50th, yeah?
No. Oh, God, you're so funny.
I know.
Another old Navy mate that was from Hobart, and when Deadly mentioned, my friend Deadly, he's called David. Hello, Deadly. my other friend Richard said, oh, just before coming to the pub, I was at home visiting my parents, who his parents would probably be late 60s, early 70s sort of thing, playing Carcassonne with them.
There you go.
And he said, and I said, oh, you play board games? And then that whole conversation up, because Deadly, he's a regular listener to the podcast.
Fantastic.
Which is why he knew about Area 52, even though he'd flown in from Queensland via Perth. He knew to go straight to Area 52 as the finest purveyor of board gaming goods.
That's
my other friend then continued to tell me, this is Richard, not Deadly, that, you know, he's got kids, I think they were 8 and 12 or something like that, and they play some of those Game Right games, and other Sushi Go and other of
like
those
sandwich
games.
And what have you.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, the main takeaway from that story for me is congratulations on having two friends, Mark. That's really...
who don't live in Tasmania.
Well, look, we are the Dice Men Cometh. Apart from learning about Mark's life story, we're all about card games, board games, all of those games and things you can do on a table, in a table, around your house, all of those times. We're going to talk about lots of furry little critters this week, and then we might also talk about some not-so-furry and not-so-little critters later on as well, because we're going to talk, first of all, about arguably one of the most beautiful-looking games that has come out in recent days and weeks.
It's certainly a hotness, that's for sure.
And then we might talk about a game that is not so beautiful a little on down the track. But before we get to that, as you have already done, let's thank Area 52 for their continued support. We better throw to a song.
Have we mentioned that it's episode... Oh, you did, sorry. You did mention episode 229, didn't you?
Yeah, that'll do.
It's my memory going again.
Excellent. So let's throw to a song, Mark, and then we'll come back and talk all about the forest wheelings and dealings that is Everdell. So you are with the Dice Men Cometh. It's Edge Radio 99.3 FM.
That was Kings of Leon with Snow here on Edge Radio 99.3 FM. You are with the Dice Men Cometh, just Garth and Mark tonight. Now, Garth.
Yes.
Snow happens, I was going to say, mostly in a season of winter.
That's true.
Although here in Tasmania, it could come at any time. This game you're about to talk about, that has seasons, doesn't it?
It sure does. And actually, it kind of starts at the end of winter. or more explicitly, the beginning of spring.
Yeah.
I guess.
And so just as the snow is melting away, maybe.
That's true. And look, the game we are talking about this week is Everdell. Now, Everdell by Starling Games, designed by James A. Wilson, who has not done anything else apart from Everdell.
Pretty good start by him, then, I'd say.
It's a pretty good start. The artist is Andrew Bosley as well, who's done a bit of stuff before, but it's also got the Australian connection, which is Dan May.
Yeah.
Now, Dan May, a friend of the show. We went to a board game convention on the border where he joined us. He's credited with art direction, a bit of graphic design, and also the game and creative development. So he's had his fingers in this game.
And, look, it wouldn't be a spoiler for me to say the art in this game is absolutely one of the most beautiful games I've seen in a long time.
Yes. So what is this game for those of you playing at home? Well, Everdell is a tableau building construction game, resource gathering, worker placement. I will give you the little bit of a blurb and I'll read exactly what it says in the rule book when you open it up because it sets the tone quite beautifully.
Do it earnestly, please, Gar.
I will do it as earnestly as I want. Within the charming valley of Everdell, beneath the boughs of towering trees, among meandering streams and mossy hollows, a civilization of forest critters is thriving and expanding. Ever since famed adventurer Corin Evertail discovered the hidden realm long ago, the citizens have prospered under the shelter of the enduring Ever Tree.
Mm.
From Everfrost to Bellsong, many a year have come and gone, but the time has come for new territories to be settled and new cities established. You will be the leader of a group of critters intent on such a task. There are buildings to construct, lively characters to meet, events to host. It will be a busy year. Will the sun shine brightest on your city before the winter moon rises? And that's it. You are playing competing critters trying to make your own little slice of Ever Paradise in Everdell. The way the board will be set out is dwarfed by the Ever Tree in this pretty big three-dimensional big tree that does actually serve a purpose. However, part of the purpose is, especially when it's maxed out at four players, arguably getting in somebody's way.
Yeah, it's an obscuring side of the board for at least one person. Although I was amazed because I had seen pictures of the game with the tree when it was on Kickstarter, and I think we might have mentioned it during the Kickstarter update.
Yeah.
Then when I saw you with the box in your hand, the two didn't connect. I'm like, hang on, this has got a great big tree in it, and you've got a box that I'd say it's a little bit smaller than like your stat. Not that you know what a Ticket to Ride box looks like, Garth, because you never played Ticket to Ride. But, you know, it's smaller than that sort of standard board game size box, isn't it? Not much,
no,
but a little bit smaller. And yet it fits that amazing cardboard tree in it.
That's right. So, look, it must be said that the version we played was the Collector's Edition, which was one of the two editions you could get on Kickstarter. And it must certainly be said that Starling Games were very generous and sent us a review copy. So putting it out there, thank you very much, Starling Games.
Thank you so much.
Absolutely, really appreciated. But what is this game and how do you play? So, yes, as I mentioned before, it is a worker placement, tableau building and, I guess, city building game because, as I said before, you are constructing your own little town. Now, what are you doing? Well, the board is made up of various places where you can send your critters. Now, you'll be going to collect wood or resin or berries or pebbles. Now, they're the four main resources that you're going to be using, and essentially you're going to gather those resources to then convert them into either constructions, i.e. buildings, or to critters, which are the characters that are going to inhabit your village or your city. Now, that's going to be pretty much how you're going to spend the game. And the challenging thing for this straight away is that you're only going to start with two workers. It's because it's spring, people are maybe still waking up or they're just not getting into gear, but you've only got two workers that you're going to be able to place. And there must be at least eight starting locations that you can go to. Each of those locations, especially if you're playing at four, will be able to fit at least two workers on each spot. So there's heaps and heaps of opportunity to go and gather resources. And that's how the game's going to start. Everyone's going to start by just gathering resources because you'll also have your hand of starting cards. Now, the way it'll work, which is part of the reason that it took us a while to get started, is that you've got to figure out who the most humble player is first. Because it does say in the rules the humblest player goes first, so took us, you know, a couple of hours of arm wrestling to figure that bit out. But then the first player will get 5 cards, the second player will get 6, the third will get 7, and the last will get 8. And 8 is the hand limit. On those cards that you've got, you will see your collection of constructions or the collection of critters. And along the left-hand side, they'll tell you what they cost. And they'll cost some version of berries and resin and wood and pebbles. And your job, using your workers, is to go and get all that loot so you can start playing them down.
Now, these, I have to mention, I'm going to jump in, these resources.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in the version we've got, they are absolutely amazing. So the berries, they are like little plastic pink, rubbery-coated.
They're so squishy.
They look like blueberries, except they're pink. I mean, you could eat them. The pebbles,
don't eat them.
The pebbles are... they look like shiny, smooth river stones.
Mm-hmm.
The sticks are just little, like, little cubey, no, not cubes, little brown cylinders.
Yep.
And then the resin is the sort of the typical game crystal...
mold.
Crystals that you get in...
They're a shrinky-dinked version of the exact crystals that you'll find in Century Spice Road Golem Edition.
Yeah, look, they're in so
many
games. I've
seen them in every other game.
The fact that, you know, you don't have 4 different coloured cubes, you've got 4 different types of resources. Now, just correct me, is this something just special in the Deluxe Edition, or do all the games have the... those groovy
resources? As far
resources.
As I remember, they all have the same resources. The Collector's Edition came with metal coins instead of your normal cardboard ones. The Collector's Edition also comes with a little inbuilt expansion, which has some extra cards. Yeah. It also has a solo mode, so you get a big D8 that comes along with it. And
it's got the cover of the box, the special...
Yeah, little sleeve that goes over the box.
Glossy with gold leaf and stuff like that on it. I mean, it looks... it's absolutely beautiful.
Check out our Instagram photo if you want to get a bit of an idea of what it looks like. So you'll send your workers out to primarily gather resources. And the good thing is there's always going to be the 4 standard spots that you can go and collect your wood or your resin or your pebbles or your berries. But then you're going to have 4 forest spots. And the 4 forest spots are randomized using forest cards. And you'll just shuffle those up, put 4 of those down, and that immediately creates a bit of replayability. Because arguably you're not going to have the same 4 spots, which will be... sometimes just different enough to make them more compelling than your standard spots. Like one of them you can go to and you might be able to get 3 berries instead of 2, which is amazing because a lot of the characters cost 3 berries to be able to play. Or you'll be able to go to a spot that might allow you to discard some cards from your hand in order to gain resources. And in the game that we played only a couple of days ago, the resource that was always hardest to get was pebbles.
Yes.
The standard pebble spot gets you a single pebble, and to build a lot of buildings, you need a lot more than one single pebble.
And I did, I like that, because so many times in games you might have 3 or 4 different resources, but really they're all worth the same thing.
Mm.
And, you know, this one has, you know, the basic spot, you can get 3 sticks.
Yeah.
You can get, I think, 2 resin, 1 pebble, and 2 berries, and then there was a couple of other sort of variations of that.
Yeah.
So you've got a bit of a economy where, well, if I can find a way to turn sticks into pebbles, for example, I had a card that let me replace one type of resource with another type of resource, which, of course, pretty much every time it was the pebble I was replacing because they were really hard to come by, you find that is really interesting, and I love that little economy between the resources.
Well, let's get to that, because the worker placement part is easy to describe. You send your worker out there, they get a thing or multiple things, and it's done. What becomes immediately interesting is the card play, and you're going to be building your tableau of 15 cards maximum. That is the largest that your city is ever going to be able to get. And there are cards that cost from 0 resources up to a lot of resources. And initially at the game, you're going to be playing relatively cheap ones.
Yep.
The reason for that is that there are 5 different types of cards. You've got your Tan Traveller, which is just a little picture of a I forget. What did you do when you left home? You know,
when I tied my handkerchief onto a stick and threw it over my shoulder.
Yeah, Huckleberry Finn style.
That's right.
So those cards are, as soon as you get them into your city, the effect happens straight away.
It's immediate bonus.
And the effect might be gain a resource, or it might be do something else relating to a card.
Yeah.
You've then got the green production cards, and they're the ones that you will use to get your engine going over the course of this game, because they're primarily going to be ones that will be you get a couple of a resource, or you're able to turn a resource into another resource. Yeah. And these cards are slightly different because they'll trigger as soon as you play them, but then they're also going to trigger potentially two more times in the game at the prepare for season phase, which we'll get to in a little while, but they will give you continual bang for your buck, which is awesome. You've then got cards that are destinations in themselves. So rather than just being limited to go to the eight spots on the board, you're creating new spots, and they'll be things like universities or schools or post offices. And some of them will even allow the competing workers to come onto your spot and get the benefit, while you get a bit of a benefit as well. So whenever someone uses one of your locations, they have to give you a victory point.
And that was a really nice variation, the fact that some of those are open to everyone and some of them are only open to you, the player.
Correct. You'll then have your little blue governance ones, and they will offer certain benefits as you get along further into the game. And then you've got your purple prosperity in there. Kind of your bigger ticket items and your more expensive buildings or unique characters that you'll be building. They cost more resources, but they really combo quite well. So, for example...
And mostly combo for end-of-game scoring.
Exactly. Yeah. You might find one which is called the Ever Tree, and it might give you an initial bang of 5 points, but it'll then give you one extra point for every other prosperity card that you've got in your tableau. So depending on when you find these and when you actually are able to get them down, they may be able to help you guide your strategy in terms of what you're going to be looking out for.
Yeah, and we had like husband and wife, where the husband was one type of card, I can't remember which, and then the wife was an endgame bonus if she had a husband.
Correct. And if they both lived on a farm, then it was even better again.
Yes, that's right.
So you've got your cards in your hand, but the other thing is you're always going to have eight face-up cards in what is called the meadow. And those cards can be bought by whoever's turn it is if they have the resources to be able to do so.
Mm-hmm.
And that just means that you're always going to have options. On your turn, you'll only ever be able to do one thing. One thing will be move a worker and collect the resource, or buy a card. They're pretty much the two things that you're going to be able to do. And the game's just going to go round and round and round and round and round. Now, played out over three seasons, as we've discussed, you're going to run out of workers, especially at the start of the game, very damn early, because you only got two of them. So therein then becomes the first arguably complicated part of this game, which is the prepare for season.
Yep.
Prepare for season you can only do once your workers have all been used and they've been sent out to work. All you're going to do is drag them back home. Now, thematically, it means that you've taken care of what you need to for that particular season. You're ready to move into the next one. You're going to drag your workers home. You're going to be able to collect, first of all, one additional worker the first time you do this, one extra worker the second time you do this, and then the third and final time you get two. So potentially you'll end up with six workers by the end of the game, which means you'll be able to potentially do so many
things. There's a real accelerating curve
into what
you can do and how many different actions you can do. But that is then contrasted by the fact that, as you said, you can only put 15 cards in your tableau. And if you sort of peek too early and get excited, Garth, about putting out cheap cards quickly, then when you've got all those workers to do all those things, you may not have many spaces in your tableau left to fill, Garth.
That is remarkably accurate. It's like you were watching someone play a game. So the prepare for season thing is really cool because it allows you to get more actions and allows to do more things, which is right up your alley, Mark.
Yes.
What it also allows you to do is to trigger those green production cards again, which is going to get you more stuff, which means you'll be able to then buy more stuff, which is fantastic. So you start getting this really good combination going. Now, for me, the joy in this game is all about the synergy in your cards. So you'll find that a hell of a lot of the constructions are paired up with a hell of a lot of critters.
Yes.
And rather than having to pay for the resources, a la Seven Wonders, I guess, if you have the right construction, you'll be able to play a critter for free.
Yeah, very clever.
So if you've got the courthouse, you'll be able to basically take a little token and signify that you've used the courthouse to build a judge for
free. Here come the judge.
Correct. Or if you've got the school, you'll be able to get the teacher. Or if you've got the cemetery, you'll be able to get the undertaker. And all of these things, which are fantastic because ultimately those cards work in a really good synergy, which just means that your engine gets a little bit stronger by doing that. Now, there's a crap ton of cards in this game. There are heaps and heaps and heaps. Let me look at the rules.
It's a massive stack that sits under that tree.
128 construction and critter cards, so a fair few. But in our game most recently, you saw almost all of it. Yep. In fact, we did go
through the whole deck.
Which is amazing, especially considering that three of the four of us were looking for a chapel card. Whether it ever turned up, I'm not sure.
Yeah, and because there are quite a few actions where you're discarding cards.
Yes.
Either to get more cards, to get resources, or to get victory points. So we did tend to churn through them, that's for sure. Which is great because you get to see all the lovely art.
Indeed.
And I guess you get to dive in to find those rarer cards, which there are a few of them.
Mm. So, there's how you play the game.
Would you like me to tell you how you win the game?
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
Yes!
Wow, you're bragging about winning a game, Mark. That sounds like someone I know. So, look, this game, yes, you will win by simply having the most victory points. Victory points come from the cards that you have been able to play in your tableau, victory points you've been able to accrue, events you have been able to achieve, because as soon as you get three of a certain type of card or four of a different type of card, you can go and claim an event, which will give you some points. There are special events that you can get points on if you've got a combination of the right cards in your city as well. There are lots of ways to earn points, but there's only really one way to lose points, and that is with arguably a card that I think about tearing up in the game, which is called the Fool. And the Fool is worth negative victory points. It's the only thing I can see that's worth negative points. And the great thing is it is a character worth -2 points that if you play three berries, you have the joy of putting it into someone else's tableau, which and is what Oren did to me.
I was going to say, it doesn't sound that bad, except when it's expertly played, as it was when we played, into your 15th spot of your tableau.
Correct.
And you happen to be holding in your hand some super duper rare card like the Evertree that's like a bonus point machine.
Yeah.
And then you had no mechanic to no way of getting rid of any of those 15 cards.
Yeah, it was fun.
Because there are cards that let you trash other cards. Like I seem to remember there was a crane, I think, where you build the crane first and then you basically destroy the crane, or signifying that you use it to reduce the resources need to play another card and the crane is trashed. Likewise, there was the dungeon?
There's the ruins.
Oh, that's right, the ruins, where it allows you to trash another card and basically get the resources from that card, which then, of course, turns it into ruins, which is very thematic. So there are little ways to sort of manipulate your tableau, but
not many.
Not massively. Yeah.
No, so this bloody fool that went into to my tableau, Oren, it must be said, spent about 3 or 4 minutes giggling to himself like a little school child before doing this, because he saw that one spot that I had in my tableau and he played it, and it was like all his Christmases had come at once. He was so happy.
Oh, yes.
I had to tell Dan May about this, so I did message him and I said, this card cost me 11 points. And he goes, I don't think that's possible. When I explained that what it meant was I couldn't play my Evertree, which was worth initially 5 points.
Yeah.
And because I couldn't play the Evertree, I then couldn't claim the other 4 points that it was going to give me because I had these other prosperity cards, which is 9 points.
Plus the minus two
makes it 11. His initial response, apart from a lot of laughy emojis, was, oh, I'll let James Wilson, the designer, know about that because he'll think it's hilarious.
And it was.
Glad I've made your time. It's so funny.
It was. Look, I really enjoyed this game.
Now,
not just because I smashed you and the other guys we played with, but look, it's so gorgeous to look at. There's lots of interesting choices, but it's not too thinky. And I don't know if I've ever played a game where you've got that combo of worker placement and card play. So on that first turn, yes, you've only got two workers, so you can only do two worker actions. But if you can get enough resources to then play cards, you might actually end up taking four or five actions all up, because you might get to play three cards. I'm trying to think of something that is a bit similar that combines those two things together, and I can't think of it.
No, I can't off the top of my head.
Not with the sort of that the tableau building thing.
So there's a couple of things wrong with this game, I think. The first one is that the rule book isn't as clear as it needs to be, I think. So the big confusion around this for us the very first time, and we did need to stop and reset, is all about this prepare for season action. Now, the prepare for season action is basically you're dragging back your workers, you're triggering your green production cards again, but then that doesn't make it clear that you can then just keep going with your next season while other players are still thematically in the other season. Now, the thematic reason behind this, according to Dan, is that just think of you all working in different climates or different climes of a forest. So, you know, I might be in a lush green area, so it gets to be summer there quicker before you're in the cold depths of cold heights of a hill. But it's not explicitly said in the rule book, and we did need to BGG and do a bit of research, because the first time we did it, we just sort of went, okay, well, you just have to skip your turns until everyone's ready.
Yeah, we sort of made that gamer assumption of, well, surely we would then wait until everyone's finished and then start the next season together.
Yeah.
But thematically, it makes sense. Now, did we mention, sorry to take you back to your point, just because this is interesting, I think. Did we mention that you've got your four different types of meeple? So each person has a different meeple that's a different creature.
Yeah, you got your porcupines and your squirrels and your turtles.
Rabbits,
yes.
They're gorgeous little wooden meeples. They really are. Once again, if you check out our Instagram or Twitter feed, you will see the photo that I posted with these lovely little meeples. They are gorgeous. But I guess thematically, you know, hedgehogs might hedgehog away, you know, the resources they need, and then be able to start doing other stuff earlier than, say, rabbits might have to run around and do the thing that rabbits do in spring, and then they might get a bit worn out and they might need a bit more of a rest. So it ties in quite nicely, but I agree, it certainly could have been explained a little bit better in the rules.
Correct. And the other thing is, this tree is beautiful, but it does get in the way. The reason it gets in the way, I think, though, is a lot of the cards, because that art is so amazing, the text on the card becomes really quite tricky to read, especially if you're trying to lean over and look at the cards in the meadow.
Yeah.
The main issue I have for that is the cards that are the destinations. So these are the ones that you really need to try and keep an eye on what your opponents have got. You need to be able to see what destinations can I potentially go to. And you need to be able to see what the action is that you are able to then do. And I just think that the destination cards arguably could have looked a little bit different so that it was easier to see from various corners of the table to see, oh, well, if I go over there and I can place my worker in Mark's post office, that'll allow me to do a thing. Most of the time when we talked about this at the table, we had to ask, okay, what does it do? Can you explain it to me?
Yeah.
And I think that was just, you know, one of those situations where the look of the game and the art was arguably too important.
Yeah, well, look, for me, I think the only one knock that I've got on this game is, now, help me out here, Garth, what were those endgame scoring special cards?
Oh, the special events.
Yeah, so the special events. Now, with those, you needed pretty much all the ones we saw, and I don't know if there's different ones in there, were a combination of a specific critter and a specific construction.
Yep.
And they weren't the ones that were paired.
No.
So you wouldn't necessarily get the two of them together. So there was like a dungeon and a ranger maybe, and there was they do go together, the teacher and the university, but the university wasn't the one that let you get the teacher
for free.
There was
a clock tower and a chip sweeper.
Yeah. So the pairs that were of things that were on there didn't necessarily go together. There was only four of those. And I guess it's very random because it's a random game, because you're drawing cards, you might be lucky and have two of those cards in your opening hand. You might be lucky and see them, or you might not be. I mean, we were sort of diving through the card deck towards the end trying to find them, because they were worth not an insubstantial amount of points. And I guess I think I got two of them, and you might have got two, maybe, because only one person can claim them. I guess I wonder, given the randomness of them, whether they're really needed at all. Do they add much to the game? It is great to have those sort of endgame scoring, but given they're just based on what cards come out, I don't know.
I think it's probably designed to help you, again, guide strategy for what cards, because it's amazing how quickly you will go from having zero cards to having 5 to 10 cards all in your tableau, and then you really go, oh, I've got to put the brakes on.
Yeah.
Because I had 11 or 12 cards in my tableau before I even got to autumn.
Yes.
So I had 3 cards that I was able to play with my last season when I had 6 workers available. So I really had to sort of spare it back, and then Buddy Oren put the fall out, so that ruined that. But anyway, so I think there's a couple of things that aren't right. There's a really big BGG file, 16 pages of questions that were answered by the designer.
Okay.
Because a lot of people have said the cards aren't quite as clear as they need to be. We didn't experience any confusion on what the cards meant, but I don't know.
I mean, sometimes people get fairly pedantic about that sort of thing, and
exactly.
You always find that on BGG. They did... Because there is not an FAQ, but there's like a glossary
about all the cards in the back of the rule book, so that's really, really fine.
And any game with that many cards is bound to have some that can be potentially interpreted different ways.
Correct. So anyway, that's more than enough on Everdell by Starling Games and James A. Wilson. I really, really liked it. I believe we're playing it again next week, so everyone around the table really enjoyed it as well, so that's cool.
And on Kickstarter right now, to sort of maybe segue into something else we can talk about later, is the expansion.
Yeah, what's the Pearlbrook.
So a new expansion. Plus, of course, if you've missed out on Everdell the first time in the Kickstarter, you can back the base game and the expansion.
And it's
again, it looks beautiful. Mm. Masses of stretch goals, more beautiful wooden meeples, more beautiful art. So
axolotl meeples.
Oh, look.
Anyway, we better throw to a song.
We would have to say... here on Edge Radio 99.3 FM with the Dice Men Cometh, sponsored by Area 52, our wonderful local game store, that this game is very much what you would call pretty. Garth, it's probably something that no one has ever said about you. You're so pretty. By the Cranberries here on Edge Radio 99.3 FM. You're with the Dice Men Cometh. And look, thank you so much to our fantastic sponsors, Area 52. Go there at 104 Elizabeth Street, Hobart, to check out their huge range of Carcassonne, clearly, because that's where my friend bought it. but also all the other board games, card games, your manga, your comical books, your normal books. A lot of great books on subjects like movies and pop culture and things like that. Also, speaking of pops, you've got the Funko Pops.
Oh, dear.
And tell them the Dice Men sent you.
Do that exactly right. So, following on from this chat about Everdell, I wanted to have a Kickstarter chat. Now, I didn't want to have a
starts again.
Yeah, but more what I wanted to talk about is that following on from our Guildmaster chat last week, I was chatting with Kim Brayback of Good Games Publishing and just having a chat about the game and chatting about Kickstarter and chatting about a few other different things. And he raised a couple of really interesting points that I thought would be worthwhile talking about. Not insignificantly is the importance of when these games are actually released, and more importantly, when Kickstarters are about to close or to finish their campaign.
Yeah.
Because I was just chatting about, you know, it's funded, which is great, but obviously you compare it to the games that they've had recently, like the Unfair expansion, which, you know, really, really did amazing.
Smashed it out of the park.
This one's funded, but it's sort of just hit that lull, that mid-campaign lull where backers are coming in, but it's not really setting the world on fire.
What I noticed was it got quite close within about 2 days.
Yeah.
And then took about another 4 days. And look, I may be wrong here. I'm sure it took about another 3 or 4 days to get that last sort of 5 or 10%.
Yeah, that last little push across. And again, the way these things traditionally work is that if they're the standard sort of 20 to 28 day campaign, you'll see a massive influx in the first couple of days. Then you have a almost the vast bulk of the campaign will be this sort of plodding along, yeah. getting up and up and up, and then you'll have this massive rush in the last 48 hours where all those potential backers who have clicked the remind me button yep. get come their back reminded in. Email and go, wow, look at all this, it's amazing, look at all the stretch goals that have been achieved, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, and then it goes from there. But the more interesting part of the conversation, as I say, is the, I guess, the brain power that goes into the when do I launch a campaign for maximum effect.
Yes.
And the big thing that's happening just right now is that North American holidays are finishing. That yep. big holiday for the year there, spring break and all that kind of hoo-ha, is just finishing.
Summer break.
Summer break, that one. And what designers are looking for is people to be back into the routine. They're not away on holidays.
Okay.
They're back in reality.
Yep.
They're back looking at their Kickstarter
yeah,
with their
morning
coffee and doing all of those yep. things. But even that's not enough to say I want to launch in September. Now, it's sort of described as a bit of a bloodbath September in terms of Kickstarter, because every man and his dog primarily is putting stuff out there because they've held off for the July okay. and August months while people are out there sunning themselves and staying nice and dry. So September is really, really cutthroat.
Mm.
And the challenge for the designer and a creator and a company that's launching stuff is how do you get noticed
yep. get
in a market that is already very, very crowded, where the crowding is really amplified.
Yep.
And look, I did a little bit of research in this, and you'd say maybe half-assed, but there appear to be about a million, billion, trillion board game yes. projects launching on the 18th of September.
Welcome to my world, Garth, of Kickstarter research. My challenge every 3 or 4 weeks I do it is not which 10 or 15 games will I talk about, it's which 30 or 40 games won't I talk about.
That's right. So you've got to look at, when you're launching, when are people going to be around and doing their normal things?
Yep.
But then also things like, when is the average payday? What day of the week or day
wow.
of the month are people getting their pay? And it seems to be that there are, primarily for the North American market, a payday around the start of the month and a payday around the middle of the month. And that's where you see this spike
okay.
of Kickstarters launching. Now, the challenge is, when so many people are launching around the same time, how yep. do you get noticed? And this is where the joy of so many creators is that they've built up a reputation. You look at Stonemaier Games, you look at Good Games Publishing, you look at Rule and Make, you look at a lot of games that, you know, we've had some association with, and they've been able to build up a pretty solid customer base who they can market and they can keep in the loop
yep.
and they can highlight, and you can sort of go, we got this coming out, just keep your wallets ready. But for first timers, it's bloody, bloody tough.
Yes, I've noticed a real rise in that. Hey, you backers of X game, just letting you know that, you know, your game, the production schedule is going really well. Oh, by the way, our next Kickstarter is launching. I've noticed a lot more of those emails.
That's right. And it's really, I just wanted to mention that really, really briefly
okay.
and just say that it seems to be this September, even into early October, is a bit of a spike for launches.
Yeah.
You're always going to have your behemoths like your Cool Mini or Nots, where they just go in there and they just take hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Yeah,
you've got Zero Dawn at the moment.
Yeah.
You've got Starcadia Quest, which I think is a re-implementation of Arcadia Quest.
Is that right? Yes.
But then you look at Pearlbrook, which is the expansion for Everdell. Now, Everdell, when it launched, it made about $473,000.
Funded in the first, what, 6 hours?
6 hours or something like that. It was crazy. But Pearlbrook, which still has 2 weeks to go, is $420,000.
Wow.
So it's almost managed to just match that already with still 2 weeks to go in the campaign, which is speaking highly about, I guess, the reviews and
yeah.
the gameplay that people are getting out of this game.
Well, we are seeing as well, we talked about those reminder emails. How many times now do you see, just as the game is hitting people's game tables, so the fulfillment is getting out,
yep.
how many times are they launching expansion or version 2.0. One of the first ones I remember was, you know, Seventh Continent pretty much did that.
Gloomhaven.
And now we're seeing it so often. I mean, Pearlbrook, here it says, funded in 30 minutes.
That's right.
And, I mean, that was a $41,000 Australian dollar target. So it's about $30,000 American. This timing of just as all the reviews and people like us out there saying, wow, we've just got this game and it's awesome. Oh, by the way, look, the next version expansion or whatever is up on Kickstarter.
You can have it. You just need to wait another 12 months for it. Now, the other thing I found interesting, and again, my research was not at all comprehensive, but there doesn't seem to be a calendar for when games are going to be released. There are Facebook groups that try and, you know, align creators together so that they can not all launch at the same time.
Yeah, not stepping on each other's toes.
But it seems to be this little secret business of, okay, well, we know someone's going to be launching around this time, and if it's a behemoth, you've got to try and avoid that because they're just going to suck all the money out of the board gaming
space.
That's
right. You don't want another Batman or Conan or Exploding Monster, kittens. Dark Souls kittens, whatever, one of those ones, Gloomhaven, to come exactly at the time you launch your board game, because you just, how do you get cut through in that market, as we said? It's indeed just so tough.
So it's really, Kickstarter's a big business now. People are really basing their businesses on it, especially in the tabletop industry. It's certainly not exclusive to it, but it's an important part. And it's just, this has grown up so much in the maybe decade it's been around now. It's incredible, and it will continue to go gangbusters and become more marketed. It's just, I find it amazing how much it's grown in the last little while. So that was all.
Okay, well, look, that was some very interesting insight, Garth, and I think there may have been a little bit of research in there. So don't sell yourself too short. Anyway, we will zip off for another track. We'll thank our sponsor, Area 52.
Hey, Garth.
Yes.
You know what's missing in the Australian board game environment?
Oh, there's plenty of things, but what are you thinking of?
Well, you know, there's plenty of stuff you can do on your phone. We've got plenty of board games, but sometimes I just like to sit down and read.
Okay, well, that would mean you'd have to have your glasses, though, wouldn't it?
Yes.
That's a big thing. I have a feeling that I might know what you're talking about.
Well, I hope so, because I need some reading.
Well, the good thing is, unlike you who are pushing the bad side of 50, I know that there is a magazine that is only the sprightly age of 25.
Wow.
Which means that even you as an old person can read something and relate to me as a young person.
Are you being ageist, Garth?
Maybe, but only pedantically.
Okay. Tell me more.
Well, what I'm talking about is the Campaigner magazine, which is a quarterly print and electronic magazine all about the gaming world that we live in.
So you can get the OG version in like 1.0 cardboard paper type stuff.
Yeah.
Or the 2.0 electronical version.
Exactly. You sound so with it.
Yeah.
So each issue includes a game feature where game designers and publishers explain the process they went through in creating a particular game. It also includes articles and interviews with subjects centered on the community, lifestyle, creativity, and even, for you, education.
Fantastic. I love me some edumacation about games and designers.
Well, not only that, but you can get the latest news, interviews, potentially even with Australia's leading board game podcast, previews and reviews on games, all of those in the magazine, which is the Campaigner magazine, and also on their website, because even though this magazine comes out every quarter, and by the way, you can subscribe for only $38 a year, you can jump onto their website, thecampaignermagazine.com, to purchase back issues. And do you know that you only get to pay what you want to pay for these electronic issues?
Really?
Yeah, bargain.
And I heard a rumour that on the latest issue...
Oh, hello.
There's a very unattractive photo of a certain Dice Man.
Well, maybe it was going to either be the Campaigner or Victoria's Secret that photo featured on.
Okay.
I'm glad that Matt, the editor of the Campaigner magazine, decided, yeah, I was good enough for his cover.
I think I'm going to have to check out the Campaigner magazine. And how can I find it online again?
Well, it is the website, thecampaignermagazine.com. It's not just a hobby, it's a way of life. Well, there you go. That was Dirt by K.D. Lang. I haven't heard a K.D. Lang song in about 100 million years. But anyway, that was K.D. Lang with Pay Dirt. You are with the Dice Men Cometh on Edge Radio at 99.3 FM. Mark.
Garth.
It's your turn to talk.
Triassic Terror.
Ah!
Is a game for 2 to 6 players. It was designed by Peter Hawes, a fantastic Australian designer. He's also designed that amazing game Francis Drake, Royals. been a little bit quiet for a while. Maybe we should be expecting a new Peter Hawes game
soon. I was
soon.
Actually looking at that and I can't see anything on the horizon. Yeah. So, Peter.
Yeah. Now, this game was published by Peter's company, I think it was, KL Games, and then Eagle Griffin, I think, sort of, I don't know if they took it over or purchased it or whatever they did. Eagle Griffin put out a really nice version. It's his take on the classic area control game inspired by El Grande, as told to ex-Dice Man Trent.
That's right.
In an interview with Peter Hawes, and if you want to check it out, it's a great interview, actually. That's episode, believe it or not, 37 of the Dice Man. Here we are in episode 229, and that was in episode 37. So it is a great little interview. Triassic Terror... Oh, sorry, Garth.
Well, I was just going to say that I have a feeling Triassic Terror was the very first what we've been playing I talked about way back when as well.
Oh, okay, really?
Yeah, I think I may have done it episode 50-odd.
Well, there you go. Well, I guess it's long overdue
for a retalk, though.
Yeah, in our theme of we've been getting back to the table some of these great classic games, Triassic Terror is a game for 2 to 6 players. Now, starting with just one herd in the swamp, players must establish new herds of dinosaurs, that is, grow them into larger herds which will migrate across the 4 environments present, competing for the best habitats. This primeval world is, however, full of dangers. Players' dinosaurs will fall prey to the mighty T-Rex, the marauding Velociraptors, and swooping pterodactyls.
Oh, the pterodactyls!
Erupting volcanoes will devastate some areas, if you remember to make them erupt, and fill the skies with ash, making the affected area almost unlivable. The player who best avoids these dangers and maintains the largest herds across all 4 environments will win. Now, this is a great little game. Of course, straight out of the box, you've got a two-sided game board, and we love double-sided board technology. So one side for 2 to 4 players, the other side for 5 to 6 players. And on the board, you've got an island, just like Tassie or Australia.
Or Jurassic.
Yep. And it's got 4 different environments represented by 4 different sort of coloured and textured areas. You've got the swamp, the forest, the desert, and the mountains. And each environment contains 3 areas separated by, from each other. You've got 12 areas in total on the board, that means. And then each of the areas has circles, a big one, a medium one, a small one. They're called, would you believe it, the primary habitat, the secondary habitat, and the tertiary habitat. But what they are is spots for your dinosaurs to go, and the biggest herd will get to go in the primary habitat because each of those habitats will have, well, most of them will, have a little, what they call a scoring stone, or in fact the number of points that it's worth when correct. You score it. Although in some of them, the third one is not worth any points.
Oh, I know that one. I know that one really well,
actually. You're fighting over those. So on your turn, a player can do one of 6 available actions, and they're represented by tiles. You can have new environment, which lets you move your dinosaurs to a new environment.
Just create a whole new herd
create
in a new
a
environment.
Whole new herd
even.
In a new environment.
Yeah.
You have herd growth, which lets you grow a couple of your herds to have more dinosaurs. You have herd migration, which that's the one that lets you move your dinosaurs from one environment to the other. You can hatch more dinosaurs. But when those little eggs are hatching, must be that crickle crackle of hatching eggs that attracts the pterodactyls to come and eat someone.
Not yours, though. Hopefully someone else's
that's
dinosaurs.
That's right. Mm. And then you've got the T-Rex. So talk about overblown production. You've got a T-Rex whose only job in the game is to fill the spot until someone else picks up the T-Rex tile and then puts their own coloured T-Rex down. How awesome is that? Because you've got your own T-Rex and then you've got your own little dinosaur that you put on the tile. The last tile is the Raptors, which lets you move these 2 Velociraptors. Again, did I mention these are all little plastic dinosaurs?
So cool.
So you've got wooden dinosaur meeples which represent your herds because you've got lots of them. And then you've got the little plastic T-Rex and the raptors and the pterodactyl is a disc.
Yeah, it's a wooden
interestingly.
Disc.
you've got 3 geological periods, the Triassic, the Jurassic, and the Cretaceous. And in each of those periods, you have 3 opportunities to have a turn, 3 turns. And then at the end of each of those 3 periods, there's like a mini scoring. And then at the end of all of them, you've got the maxi scoring. So
I didn't find any maxi scoring on that last round. I must admit I was going nowhere fast.
Yeah, so in the mini scorings, if you get the points for the what are they called? The habitats that you're in, primary, yep. secondary, tertiary. But then if you happen to have at least one herd in all four environments, you get some bonus points. And then at the end in the maxi scoring, first and second in each of the four environments, so the swamp, forest, desert and mountains, gets bonus points.
Yeah, whoever has the most dinosaurs in each of those environments.
And look, it's quite simple. You've got, you basically each turn you'll go around, you'll place your... mine was a Stegosaurus.
Yeah, I had a Triceratops, I think.
Yeah, I think Trent had a Brachiosaurus or something. So you've got your own unique dinosaur that all you use it for is to place on the tile, and that will then signifies which what the turn order is and what action you're going to do. And then you've also got some cards where you are drawing cards which give you a – it's like a special new environment – action, except when you take the new environment tile, you can pick one of the four environments. In this case, the card will have one of the environments on it. So it's like a bonus action. You can play one of those in each of the sets of three ages, groups. Yeah. You've also got two little tiles, which are two special actions that you can only play once in the game. One is a special hatch action. So just get more dinosaurs. And then one is the aforementioned volcano. And when the volcano goes off, it will kill some dinosaurs, but basically it will also freeze out everyone from moving into or out of the area where the volcano goes off. So the timing of when you use those, or in fact if you use those, is sort of critical.
Sure is, because you can forget to do that, because you're only allowed, yes, to play them once per game,
yep.
but you can only play one per age again,
yeah.
Jurassic, Cretaceous, da-da-da-da-da, and three of the four players forgot to do that.
So, Garth, what did you think? We hadn't played this one, as we said. It must be 3 years, 4 years
at
since
least.
We got this one to the table?
Yeah, look, this game, I love this game. It is so awesome, and I guess comparing it to El Grande is exactly where you want to sort of advertise this game.
Yeah.
It's ugly. It's really not an attractive-looking game. It certainly needs to be updated, I think, from a graphic design point of view.
Well, the colour scheme is not amazing, that's for sure.
No. But who doesn't want to play with plastic miniature dinosaurs? And this game is brutal, because imagine El Grande if your people could get eaten all the time.
That's right.
Which is what happens.
El Grande with cannibals.
Oh, it's tough. And the decisions you make, they're going to be pretty easy decisions, because a lot of the time you might only have a choice of two or one of those tiles to be able to choose. So your action might be really chosen for you, but God, it's what you do with that action that can make or break not only your own game, but your competitors as well.
And there's a couple of really interesting little twists, like the fact that if when your dinosaurs move from one environment to another, they experience environmental shock, which in fact causes one of your dinosaurs to die. But because they're migrating in herds, they basically suck in one of everyone else who's in that same area as you and take them with you. And then those dinosaurs, of course, now they're part of yours.
Yeah,
herd.
They go from being your opponent's dinosaurs to yours, and it's amazing how often they are the dinosaurs that die.
That's right. It's almost like it's planned that way.
Exactly.
So, look, those couple of little twists for me, and the fact that you're playing with plastic dinosaurs, and this is... Look, El Grande is a classic for a reason, and we played that quite recently, and we absolutely loved it. But in terms of area control, look, let's just say I'd play this 1,000 times more sooner than I would play Inish again, that's for sure.
The thing is, this game, I reckon you can get this game for not much money these days. I remember picking it up for 30 or 40 bucks.
Well, it's certainly not well known, that's for sure. I mean, it's screaming out for a reprint with some beautiful new graphic design, maybe bigger dinosaur minis. Peter, what are you waiting for?
Yeah, it's not an attractive game, but the gameplay itself makes up for it. So, yeah, Triassic Terror, I would happily play this again. I need to make a big lot of changes, because I lost by about 40 points.
Well, the problem was you shot out fairly quickly off the mark, and then, of course, you had all the dinosaurs gnashing at your heels to bring you back to the pack, and then you couldn't really recover,
could you? Not at all.
And Carl, our friend Carl, as so often he does in these type of games, he sort of swept up quietly and calmly while we were all eating each other and snuck through for the win. Now, We've run out of time again, Garth.
I know. It's amazing how often that happens.
We've got Neil here waiting to come in and play his hard rock show. But before we go, thanks so much again to Area 52, our great sponsors. Thanks to Edge Radio for having us every Thursday. Thank you for listening in and for checking out our Facebook and our Instagram and our Twitter account. We've been posting some great photos there, particularly on Instagram, of the fun games we've been playing. And we'll be back again next week to talk about more games.
Again, just the two of us. Leon will be away again at work.
Yay! I mean, oh no.
Yeah. Bye.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to another episode of The Dice Men Cometh. Thanks to Area 52, Hobart's best ventilated game store, and more. Find out more on area52.com.au. They support The Dice Men, and you can too, at Patreon, for as little as just $1 per month. It's not a lot to ask for podcasting gold.